everyone, and welcome to this audio conference training for rural grantees of the Office on Violence Against Women. Our topic for today is serving battered women with disabilities and battered women who are deaf. So I am thrilled to welcome Amy to have her join us today. She brings a great deal of experience and enthusiasm and passion in advocating for people with disabilities who've experienced domestic and sexual violence. And I'm just going to, Amy, ask you, I think, at this point, if you would, go ahead and provide a little more context for us for our discussion today, and then you can go ahead and launch into your PowerPoint.
Okay, that sounds good. Thanks, Liz. First of all, I just want to say to all of you that it is indeed an honor for me to talk with you today. I feel very passionately about people with disabilities and victims and survivors of domestic and sexual violence. So I always find talking about these issues very engaging, and I want to encourage folks, if you have questions or comments, feel free when we stop and have that opportunity to put forth any comments or questions that you have, because I think we all continue to learn about these issues. Very briefly, I know you all have my bio, but I just wanted to highlight a couple things for you about the work that we're doing around people with disabilities and violence. First of all, I just want to tell you that part of the reason why I'm so passionate about this is because I do have two family members with disabilities. I come from a very large family, and I am actually a guardian for one of them. It's actually my twin brother with autism. I also have a great respect and admiration for those of you who do the work directly with victims and survivors of domestic and sexual violence. I work very closely on a collaborative project with the Wisconsin Coalition Against Domestic Violence and the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And together we've been working, for the last 8 years formally, but really for closer to about 15 years informally, on issues related to people with disabilities and domestic and sexual violence, really trying to work together collaboratively and work with community-based programs to increase collaboration and enhance people's comfort and skill in working directly with victims and survivors who have disabilities. That is an OVW-funded project that we're working on, and as I said, we're in our eighth year, and it's something that we all get excited about over and over again and travel around the state. So, again, thank you for this opportunity. What I want to do is just walk through with you the PowerPoint that will frame what we're talking about today. We're going to talk about people with disabilities and domestic and sexual violence and some of the specific unique issues that arise for these victims and survivors and some of the unique, barriers or struggles that people with disabilities who are victims and survivors experience, especially in rural communities. So to start off, what I wanted to do, and don't worry, I'm not going to go into a long history, but I wanted to kind of set the landscape for you by starting with the brief historical perspective. And the reason why I wanted to start here is because it really impacts understanding the history and the context. It impacts our understanding of people with disabilities now as a group, who over time and even currently have experienced oppression and discrimination due to the fact that they have a disability. Certainly not everyone, but many, many people with disabilities experience both oppression and discrimination. Understanding the historical context also impacts how we as advocates interact with people with disabilities. We're part of society. We share some of the same myths and stereotypes and issues as everyone else. And so this can impact our interactions that we have with folks coming through our doors. And finally, as we all know what happens with victims and survivors, it also impacts those systems, whether it's the criminal justice system, whether it's the human services system or other systems, it impacts how those systems respond to people with disabilities, especially those who have experienced violence. So when you think about the mainstream history of people with disabilities, I just wanted to highlight that it's been a long, often hidden history for many of us who may not have had a family member or a neighbor or a close friend with a disability. People with disabilities often were either hidden in homes or hidden in institutions. You just didn't see them on the street. You didn't see them in grocery stores or at church or temple. And that really is a concrete piece of the history that you have to think about when you're talking with and working with people with disabilities, because being out in the community, being a part of everyday life as all of us want to be, for some folks is a newer experience. And for others who don't have disabilities, they might feel less comfortable, less sure about an approach because they're just not used to it. They haven't experienced it. I also wanted to highlight that for people with disabilities, forced sterilization was something that was constitutional until the 1950s. It was basically believed that you didn't want to have offspring of people with disabilities. In fact, one of the Supreme Court justices in a famous case regarding sterilizing people with disabilities said three generations of imbeciles are enough. So, you know, there has been stigma, there's been discrimination, there's been oppression, yet things are changing, and they've been changing a lot since pretty much the 60s. The civil rights movement was kind of the onset. And basically what's happened is a shift. It's about putting the decisions about themselves for people with disabilities in their own hands. And that's where the phrase, nothing about us without us, really comes into fruition. And the idea is getting people with disabilities themselves involved in decisions that impact their lives. And I think those of us as advocates, certainly with victims, survivors in general, we know the importance and primary role that people who have experienced violence, the central role that they play in determining the course of their lives. And that holds true for people with disabilities as well. So let's talk a little bit about who we are going to focus on in this audio conference. So if you look at the next slide, what are disabilities? I just wanted to give you a flavor that sometimes you have to figure out what the context is of the conversation. If you're talking with lawyers, they're going to look at legal definitions of what a person with a disability is and how that's defined. So they might be looking at the Americans with Disabilities Act, or more recently, the ADA Amendments Act, the Americans with Disabilities Amendments Act. If you're talking with a therapist or someone from the human services context, they're going to be looking at clinical definitions. So, for example, they might label someone as having a bipolar disorder or autism spectrum disorder. And then for some individuals, they're going to be talking about disabilities from a cultural context. For example, the deaf community. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. So I just wanted to let you know that when you're talking about people with disabilities in general, depending on who's talking and in what context, you want to be clear about how they're defining who they're talking about. So if you look at the next slide, this was just designed as a way for all of us to be have a common understanding of what we're talking about when we talk about people with disabilities. If you look on the left-hand side, those are the four main categories that people think about when they're talking about disabilities. Someone with a cognitive or intellectual disability. Someone with a physical disability. So, for example, maybe a spinal cord injury. Someone who has a sensory disability would be someone who, for example, is blind or has low vision, or someone who's hard of hearing or deaf. And then psychiatric disabilities are individuals who have mental health issues such as serious depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia. If you look to the right side of the line, where it says developmental, acquired, or age-related, that side of the line is basically to give you a picture of the context, the onset of the disability. So, for example, someone who has an intellectual or cognitive disability, let's say it used to be called mental retardation, that's considered developmental, meaning the age that the person acquired that developmental disability occurred before the age of 22. Okay? So developmental is basically the age of onset. So if it happened before an individual reaches age 22, then it's called a developmental disability. Some people acquire disabilities, whether it's due to a traffic accident, a car accident. It could be due to getting cancer. Another very common way of acquiring a disability, as probably this group listening knows very well, and that is violence. Traumatic brain injury, strangulation, those kinds of violence can cause disabilities of all kinds. And then there are age-related disabilities. Especially as our population ages, we're becoming much more aware of disabilities that are acquired due to age, such as dementia, Alzheimer's, which is a form of dementia, diabetes, heart disease, those kinds of things. So those are the types of disabilities and then how they are acquired and the age of onset. And disabilities can be both hidden and visible, as we all know. Someone using a wheelchair or a cane or a walker, you can see that that individual has a disability. However, someone who has epilepsy, someone who has some form of a mental health issue or even diabetes, they might be sitting right next to you. You might have worked with them for 20 years and never know that they have a disability. So they are both hidden and visible. If you look at the next slide, I specifically broke out the deaf community, and I did this basically because I think all of us are becoming more aware that while people who are deaf are considered people with disabilities under legal definitions, there is a group of individuals who self-identify as being deaf with a capital D. And that's really a cultural self-identification. They do not consider themselves to have disabilities, although legally they are. And they really consider themselves different from individuals who can't hear but don't culturally identify as being from the deaf with a large D community. Part of it is there is a whole deaf culture that exists for people who self-identify as part of the deaf with the big D community. And they basically associate together. They have a common language that they use, which is American Sign Language. And they have strong identity as deaf. So I wanted to make sure that we're all aware that while I'm talking about people with disabilities generally and including people who are deaf as well as identify as culturally deaf, that working directly with someone who identifies as deaf with a big D, that they really see themselves as not having a disability. And that's just something to be aware of. I also want to bring up as well that American Sign Language, or ASL, is not English being signed. It has a different syntax. Words have different meaning. It's really a visual language. So signing exact English is not the same as American Sign Language. So if someone knows English as well as knows ASL, they really know two different languages. And for many people who identify as deaf with a large D, ASL is their first language, and English may or may not be something that they feel comfortable and competent using. So just be aware of that. So why are we focusing on people with disabilities, battered women with disabilities, battered women who are deaf? A primary reason is because we are becoming more and more aware about the rates of violence that are occurring among people with disabilities. And there are many studies that are out there that have different numbers, as we all know with all kinds of studies. But what I wanted to do is just put on this PowerPoint one of the more recent compilations of information regarding the prevalence and incidence of violence against people with disabilities. And what we do know is that rates of violence, whether it be sexual assault or violence in general, is higher for people with disabilities than in the general population. And depending on the studies, I mean, there's one study that a number of people cite that basically says that 90% of individuals with developmental disabilities will experience sexual abuse in their lifetime. And out of those 90%, almost half will experience sexual assault 10 or more times. There are a number of different studies that look into different things and different categories of people with disabilities. But what we do know over and over again is that the rates of violence are startling, and as we know for anyone, too high. So part of what we need to do then is think about, why are people with disabilities at increased risk? Why are the rates so high? What I wanted you to do is just to take a moment, if you could, if you have a paper and pen in front of you, just take a few seconds and jot down what comes to mind for you when you think of people with disabilities and what makes them at increased risk for violence. Just take a few seconds to jot a couple ideas down. Okay, let's look at some of the factors that I listed, and I'm sure there are more. Without walking through every one, let's just highlight a few. First of all, we know that for many people with disabilities, especially in rural communities, isolation is a key factor for increased risk. Part of the reason why is, depending on the person's disability, they can be isolated physically. So, for example, if I'm someone who uses a wheelchair because I have a spinal cord injury from the waist down, I might be very reliant on others to provide me care and support, get me around, help me use a phone, associate with others in my community. So my physical isolation due to my disability can be a risk factor for increased incidence of abuse. There's also social isolation. I will tell you, growing up in a family with someone with a disability, you end up kind of being by yourself. People don't necessarily want to associate with you because they don't understand what's going on in your household or the person that has the disability. That can happen for families, and it definitely happens for individuals themselves, especially when they're younger and trying to break into the world. That social isolation can be a critical factor to increased risk. We also know that some folks with disabilities have issues related to thinking and processing and understanding. They may have diminished capacity to understand what's happening to them, or as with many of us that grow up in violent households, we know what we know. And so we might not be aware that what's happening to us is abuse. Part of that, and what I want to emphasize here, is a lot of kids with disabilities, even those that go to regular school systems, usually are taken out of the classroom when issues of healthy sexuality or relationships are talked about. And so a lot of kids with disabilities, for example, never get information on sexuality as well as abuse. And so they have no information, no context, no understanding for what might be happening to them, either as children or as adults. The other piece of that, and thinking about that kind of information, is a lot of kids who are deaf, as well as adults, also don't gather the information about healthy relationships or abuse and what some of the factors and issues are, because we learn a lot of information incidentally. We overhear conversations or we hear something on the radio. Those avenues of learning are not open to deaf who don't have some kind of interpreter available where they can actually get the information. Another big issue that comes up as far as a risk factor for people with disabilities, and I will tell you, abusers use this factor well, and that is credibility. I hear from women story after story, especially women with cognitive disabilities and women with mental illness, that an abuser will basically say something like, you know, everyone knows you're crazy. Everyone knows you've been hospitalized. No one's going to believe you if you report. That actually puts, as we all can understand, a person at increased risk for additional domestic violence. The other issue I wanted to highlight is the culture of compliance. And I know I'm walking through these slowly, but these are the realities that many people with disabilities live with from birth to death. And the culture of compliance is one that I think we're becoming more and more aware of. What it does is, unfortunately, it sets up a lot of people with disabilities as quote-unquote good victims. And that is that people with disabilities are basically groomed to listen to the person in charge, listen to the person who's in authority. I'll tell you, my twin brother, who's the same age as me, he's 48. When he and I talk about something, he'll still ask me, what's the consequence going to be, for example, if he doesn't want to do something, or is that the rule? And what I mean by that is there's this kind of ingrained way that people with disabilities have been taught to always do what they're told. And that, as I think we can all imagine, someone who targets someone with a disability, an abuser who basically wants to maintain that power and control, that really sets someone up to continue to be victimized over and over again. So who's committing the kind of violence we're talking about? Basically, a lot of folks. Strangers, as we know, and actually there are some studies that point out, at least with sexual assault, that there is a higher percentage of strangers that commit sexual assault against specifically individuals with developmental disabilities. Acquaintances have been known as well to commit violence, and some of that we have to be aware of by how the person with a disability defines an acquaintance. So, for example, some women that I've worked with that have cognitive disabilities, what used to be called mental retardation, they talk about people that live in their building, they live in an apartment building, as their friends. And I'll ask some additional questions about what they do with these friends. Well, they're someone that they see down at the same mailbox. So an understanding of what a friend is versus an acquaintance may be different depending on a person's situation, but we do know acquaintances have committed sexual violence and domestic violence in the context of people with disabilities. Caregivers, unfortunately, whether they're family members, volunteer, or paid caregivers, have been a significant portion of folks that commit violence against people with disabilities. A lot of it has to do with the power and control dynamics of the person in charge, the fact that if I'm relying on you, for example, to help me get out of bed and change my clothes and toilet and take a shower, the ability and the power that you have to commit violence against me is tremendous. We also know that because some people with disabilities live in congregate living settings, group homes, adult family homes, as well as institutions, that peer-to-peer violence, unfortunately, is pretty common. I just wanted to highlight for you, and I'm not going to go into detail, we're all aware of what some of the indicators of abuse are. I just wanted to note that for people with disabilities, there are a couple specific issues that I wanted to highlight to be aware of. If you look at some of the potential indicators of abuse, the physical indicators are common to both people with and without disabilities, although some of the specific physical indicators can be exacerbated for someone who has a disability. If you look at the behavioral indicators, a key issue, especially for someone who might not have the words or the language or the ability to communicate in a way that you or I would understand, one of the key things to be aware of is a significant change in behavior. That might be an indicator that something is going on. So it doesn't mean, for example, that because someone is talking more loudly, or maybe they're acting out more expressively with their arms and their hands, or they're more irritated than usual or whatever. It doesn't mean that abuse is taking place, but we're suggesting that should be kind of a red flag to ask some more questions, to try and figure out what's going on. For a lot of people with disabilities, if they start, quote-unquote, acting out, which is a term you hear a lot when talking about people with disabilities, people just consider it a behavior problem, as something that has to be managed, versus using it as kind of that light going on, saying, let's try and figure out what's happening for her. There might be something going on in her life that we need to be aware of. The other piece, too, is we know that abusers have become very skillful in talking with folks who are maybe trying to figure out what's happening with a person. They're very, very skillful in explaining away the abuse that they're actually committing by attributing maybe additional abusing or heightened anxiety or suicidal behavior or all kinds of things, attributing that to the disability. Versus, of course, they're not going to admit what they're doing. The hard part is those of us who then are charged with trying to work with individuals with disabilities who might be experiencing abuse or who have experienced abuse, we have to be very cautious about not colluding with the caregiver, the person who's actually committing the violence. Because sometimes maybe we have experience with a woman and she's, got pretty challenging behaviors that, for example, make me uncomfortable. And so I might feel like, oh, this caregiver, what a great person he is. You know, he's doing the best he can. She's such a handful. And what that can sound like to a victim. Especially a victim who's being abused and experiencing abuse. We unintentionally collude with that abuser. As far as the effects of abuse, I only put them in this PowerPoint because I have actually heard not only family members, but some professionals who actually and explicitly question whether or not some people with disabilities basically are affected by domestic violence or sexual assault the same way the general population is. And I found that really startling. And so I just wanted to put this in because it's important that we recognize what we see from and hear from and observe from victims and survivors with disabilities might cause us to question, okay, what's really going on here? But it may just be that the effects aren't coming across in a way that you and I are fully understanding. We've heard directly, I've heard directly from many women who have had professionals doubt their experiences and the effects those experiences had on them. So I just wanted to highlight that we have to be cognizant that some of the same effects that are occurring among victims and survivors without disabilities also occur for people with disabilities. So I'm going to stop there and just see if there are any comments or questions.
If you do have a comment or a question, simply press the number 1 once on your touchtone phone. It looks like there are no comments or questions at this time.
Okay, thank you.
Maybe we can just wait, give it a few more seconds, Amy.
Sure.
And the operator can let us know if anyone has interjected with a question or comment. But I want to just take a moment to really thank you for contextualizing the abuse of people with disabilities in sexual and domestic violence situations and kind of clarifying those effects that whether people have disabilities or not, the effects are the same. So thank you for laying that out so clearly for us.
Sure.
Operator, do we have any questions or comments at this point?
There are no questions or comments at this time.
Okay. So, Amy, let's go back into your presentation, and if in about 20 minutes, if you think we could stop again, at that point, each participant will have an opportunity to interact with Amy again. And just a quick reminder, feel free to email me any questions or comments that you would like to share with the group. You can do so by sending an email to Liz, L-I-Z, at praxisinternational.org. So, Amy, would you go ahead and continue with your PowerPoint?
I'd be glad to. Sure.
Thanks.
Okay, if we look at the next slide, which is focused on barriers to effective intervention, this is where we're starting to basically use some of the information that I just talked through to think about. One, if you're seeing people with disabilities come through your program as victims or survivors, and two, there might be some issues for you all to think about if you aren't seeing folks with disabilities. It may be a way to think about what kind of outreach you might need to do in order to ensure that people with disabilities are aware of what I call the lifeline that you all provide. So some of the barriers to intervention that I wanted to highlight specific to rural areas, and one of them is situational. What I have heard, I've been doing a lot of work in northern Wisconsin, and what I hear over and over again from people with disabilities as far as getting effective responses is their lack of access and of primary definition to that, I guess I would say, is transportation as well as poverty. Whether it's someone who uses a wheelchair and cannot access any form of accessible transportation where they can get from wherever they're living 30 miles away to maybe where a shelter is located. There's just nothing available or they don't know who to call. We also know that some of the folks that I've talked with, they don't have phones, so they don't have any way to kind of communicate with anybody about what might be happening, or they need the assistance of someone else to actually help them make a phone call. Maybe they have limited mobility use of their hands or their arms, and they don't have the funding for any kind of assistive device that would help them make a call by themselves. So the ability to connect with someone who could actually help them get out of an abusive situation is severely, severely limited. another area that comes up, especially in the context of rural communities. People with disabilities have talked with me directly about their concern about the loss of privacy, i.e. confidentiality, and independence. The whole idea that, you know, everybody knows in the town of 200 that they're the person that uses the wheelchair and has this van, and seeking any kind of assistance, even if it's 50 miles away, word travels fast. So if they call anybody else for help, one, they're concerned about others in the community knowing what's going on, as well as their abuser knowing potentially that they're trying to get out. And secondly, oftentimes for some individuals with disabilities, the abuser is also the person's caregiver. And so the loss or potential loss of independence can be a really not only scary thing and frightening thing, but also in many rural communities a reality. We know of situations where women who have had their caregiver, who's the abuser, reported, end up in nursing homes because there's no other support provider available that can help that woman on a day-to-day basis if she doesn't have her abuser. For a lot of people with disabilities, going into a nursing home feels like going back into an institution and means going backwards in their lives. It's a real loss of independence. So, you know, those factors are things that we have to keep in mind. So when you think about all that, as advocates, what are some of the initial considerations that you might want to take into account when working with people with disabilities? And again, you might not know the person walking through your door or calling on your crisis line has a disability, but these ideas in some ways might be good practice to consider for everyone, because I might not, for example, feel comfortable sharing with you that I have this bipolar disorder when I call because I'm in imminent danger and I need to come into shelter. But as I build trust, as I get a sense of the respect and response that you all have given me and I feel welcome, I might be more willing to share that information. And that's because of, remember at the beginning I talked about that oppression and stigma and discrimination. Some people, especially those who have hidden disabilities, rightly understand that it's not always in their best interest to let someone else know that they have that particular label. So some initial things to think about is, first of all, the idea of using person-first language, and some of you may be really familiar with this. The idea is you put the person before the disability. So that's why I've been describing people with bipolar disorder, people with autism, people who have a spinal cord injury. It's the person first. In a lot of settings, I'll hear people talk about a bipolar or he's an autistic. Well, you know, he's not just the diagnosis. He's more than that. He's a person first. And part of the way we can really engage people is to try and not get distracted by a person's disability. If they're coming to you, they're coming to you because they've experienced some form of domestic or sexual violence and are concerned about their safety. So it's really focusing on what happened to that person versus what's wrong with that person. And in the disability context, people with disabilities and being a family member of one throughout my life, I can tell you that the focus is always on what the person can't do and what they don't do well if they have a disability label, nothing about what's happened in their lives. So the perspective that you all have as advocates, which is really the first one, what happened to you, is a really good starting place. So I want to reinforce that. And that's really the idea of starting where the person is, and seeking permission to engage them on their own terms, matching their pace, matching their language, making sure that they can feel as comfortable and welcomed to the services and support that you all provide. There are some very specific issues that have to be clarified initially, and this might be frustrating. I know for many folks it adds another layer of what they have to be thinking about, but I think it's important that you take these initial issues into consideration when you're doing your work. There are three areas that I want to focus on. One is focusing first and foremost on client safety in the context of people with disabilities. The second is we're going to talk a little bit about some people with disabilities have substitute decision makers, examples, guardians. And then the third is there are, in some states, mandatory reporting requirements that apply to working with people with disabilities. So we're going to walk through these issues. And let me just say, when we get to the guardianship and the reporting issues, I want to be real clear. I understand they're complex, they're controversial, and they're frustrating. And I'm going to give you a flavor, as well as I've provided some resources in the binder that hopefully will help you figure out how you need to approach this. But I think it's helpful for us to at least get an initial flavor of what we have to be thinking about. So let's start first with the immediacy of client safety. What you want to do when you're looking at safety, whether the person's walked through the door or they've called saying that they need to come in and talk with somebody, or they're calling about needing to come into shelter, or even maybe they're calling because right away they know that they need a restraining order of some kind, what you want to do is think about safety in the context of a number of different factors, one being specifically related to their disability, and asking a person, you know, are there any particular issues that you deal with in your day-to-day life that we should take into account regarding your safety? So, for example, if I am a person who's hard of hearing and I have hearing aids that I use to basically navigate through my day, and my abuser has threatened to destroy those hearing aids, that might be a safety issue of importance to that person who's hard of hearing. Or I'm a person who has a spinal cord injury and I have someone who provides personal care to me, and that person basically is the abuser, then that certainly is a factor that is related to my disability that needs to be thought of in the context of safety planning. For deaf, there are also some specific issues. Are they living, for example, with an abuser who is hearing? Oftentimes, deaf colleagues of mine will talk about how law enforcement or others who come in to intervene basically get all the information from the hearing person because an interpreter can't be on scene for 3, 4, or 5 hours. And so that really re-victimizes that deaf victim. So thinking about some of the safety issues specific to someone who's deaf. Culture. We know that for individuals from varying ethnic cultures, identification, that there are different ways of thinking about disability and the ramifications of disability. And so we might want to explore some of the issues. So, for example, I have had Hmong advocates talk with me about families not even wanting to admit that they have a family member with a disability because of the fact that in their particular community or clan, the family having someone with a disability puts shame on the family as if they've done something wrong. So there is a cultural context. We know, and you all know best, that a person's location, living in a rural community, just getting out of where they live, getting transportation somewhere else, knowing that maybe a neighbor is 2 miles down the road, and the person uses a wheelchair that's not even electrical, that they have to push, those are serious, serious safety considerations. So there are a number of things that you want to think about with regard to client safety. The second initial issue that you want to consider is substitute decision makers, and what I'm going to do is focus specifically on guardians. A guardian is basically someone who stands in the shoes legally of a person with a disability. So there's a guardian, and in the language of the court, the person with the disability who has a guardian is called a ward, W-A-R-D. It's not a very flattering word, but that's the word nonetheless. What I wanted to do is highlight for you what you might want to think about if you're working with someone who has a disability that you get a sense might not be fully understanding what's going on. You're wondering whether they have the capacity to make informed decisions based on the choices that you're providing. And so you're wondering whether or not this person has a guardian. First, you can ask. It's not a violation of any rights. You can ask someone, do you have a guardian? And you can basically explain that you're asking because you want to be sure that they receive the kind of help that they think would be most useful for them, and that you have to check and make sure whether or not they have a guardian so that you can be sure that they get the help that they need. And then you can walk through it in a little more detail, but you definitely want to find out in those cases where you're wondering. What the problem is that many people with disabilities, unfortunately, might say, yes, they have a guardian, but they actually don't. So let me give you some specific information on kind of how to walk through this issue. Some people with disabilities just assume that they have a guardian because they've been told that they do. So, for example, my twin brother, my mother thought that he was his guardian. He was her guardian, for example, when he turned 19, just because she was his mother. Well, only a court of law can state whether someone is a legal guardian of another person, okay? So parents of adults with disabilities often say they're the guardian, but sometimes they are not because they haven't gone to court to have a guardianship issued. So what you want to do is basically determine whether or not the person actually has a guardian, okay? And what you can do is request, and I would get informed consent from the victim or survivor, unless the guardian is the reported abuser, then you want to be a little careful about contacting the person that the individual says is a guardian. But what you want to do is get a copy of the court-issued document. In Wisconsin, we call them the guardianship letters, and the label probably varies from state to state. What you want to do is then check on that document, on that court document, specifically what the powers are of the guardian. For example, I'm guardian of my brother, but in a limited way. So that I basically have the power by the court to make certain health care decisions for him. But I don't have the power to determine what social services he receives. That's something that was left to him being able to make the decision. So what you want to do is read through that document and basically learn for the services and support that the victim or survivor is asking you to provide or that you think might be helpful to her, what you want to do is figure out whether or not you have to get informed consent from that guardian in order to provide those services and that support. Okay? Even if you have to get informed consent from the guardian, you always, always want to include the person with the disability in all those decisions. And I think as advocates, we know that victims and survivors come first, and what they need and want comes first. and you might find many situations arising where the guardian is in conflict with what the victim or survivor wants. Those are sticky issues, and I apologize for not having the time today for us to walk through how to process that. What I would recommend, certainly, is that you all in your particular agencies have some kind of discussion, and I'd certainly be glad to help pose some questions for that, as well as some scenarios, to think about how you'd walk through and work through those kinds of conflicts as they arose, so you can be prepared. I'm going to stop there before we move on to mandatory reporting, because things just become a little more complex and controversial as we move forward. So are there any questions specifically on the safety considerations or the guardianship?
Again, if you do have a question or a comment at this time, simply press the number 1 once on your touchtone phone. We'll give it just a few moments to see if we do have any questions.
Thank you, operator. While we wait to see if there are questions or comments, Amy, I wonder if I could just clarify a couple of points with you.
Sure.
You talked about the stickiness in any situation in which there is a conflict between a guardian and the person that the person is the guardian of. And so can you talk at all about cases in which the guardian is the abuser?
Sure. I actually consulted on a case where the guardian was an abuser and had almost full control over most decisions affecting the individual. The victim survivor actually was in shelter at a battered women's program, and the battered women's program basically knew that it had to provide notice to the guardian of the whereabouts of the victim survivor, because, you know, that's part of what's required. But since the guardian was the abuser, they weren't sure what to do. So we went through a process where we just talked about it. And from our perspective here at Disability Rights Wisconsin, and we're a protection and advocacy agency for people with disabilities, we basically felt that while there certainly was a liability concern on the part of the domestic violence program, that we felt that if it were challenged by the guardian, we could argue successfully a public policy reason why the shelter was not going to notify or contact the guardian about the whereabouts of the ward because that guardian was the abuser. We've also had programs that have called where they're not sure, for example, whether they can provide counseling support or whether or not the individual with a disability can participate in the support group without the guardian's informed consent. And sometimes it depends on the guardianship itself. And let's say the guardian does have to give informed consent. What the programs have done is tried to talk more in detail with the guardian about what will be covered at the support group, for example, so that the guardian is making a more informed decision. But in the end, if it's considered treatment, you know, mental health treatment, depending on the type of guardianship, that's where the conflicts can come in. And so then it's unfortunate that the guardian then controls what the victim survivor can and cannot do to heal.
Right. And so would it be prudent for a program to contact either, you know, their lawyer or a legal representative or an advocacy rights group such as yours for people with disabilities in terms of trying to navigate these very difficult situations in which the guardian is also the abuser?
Yes, I think it would be. And what I would recommend is in the resources, I provided some web-based resources. And what I would recommend programs do, and that's why I had offered, is to think through some scenarios. And you may have already experienced them, but put those scenarios down as hypotheticals and kind of walk through what the sticky issues are. Then what I would do is recommend either meeting with an attorney who's familiar with guardianship laws as well as domestic violence programs and how they operate, or to contact the Protection and Advocacy Agency or Adult Protective Services in your respective state, and just talk through and figure out what people recommend you do so that you have some kind of a plan of operation and response that you can feel confident and comfortable with if this situation ever arose.
Thank you, Amy. That's very helpful. Operator, could you tell us, are there any questions in the queue?
There is no one in the question queue at this time.
Okay, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I did receive an email from one of the listeners who wanted to just kind of offer a point of information that she had discovered. So she said that she her program had someone from the Tennessee Regulatory Authority come to a training that they were offering in regards to services for people with disabilities. And during that training, her organization learned that people with disabilities are entitled to free TTY and TTD and or speech device kind of adaptive equipment. And she just wanted to share that with the people on the line today, that if it's helpful, people should contact their state regulatory authority to see what kind of accessibility options are offered. Do you agree with that, Amy?
Absolutely. That's a great idea. That's a great idea.
And just really briefly, could you explain a bit to everyone on the phone about the TTY and the TTD?
Sure. Basically, what a TTY stands for is teletype. TTD, or what you see sometimes, TDD, those are acronyms, and it all basically revolves around the same thing. It's older technology now, so let me just tell you that, to be aware that there's lots of new technology coming out to try and make it viable for people who are hearing and people who have loss of hearing or who are deaf to communicate via telephone or other electronic devices. So a teletype, some of you might be really familiar with them. It basically looks like a phone that has two cups in it that you actually put your headset in. And it's a way where, for example, if someone's deaf who is trying to contact me, I use a TTY. So when I answer the phone, I basically type in, "Good morning, this is Amy, GA," meaning go ahead. And then what they'll do is they'll type to me, "Hi, Amy, you know, this is so-and-so. I have a question about something. GA, and then, you know, we go back and forth. So part of what I can share with you is in, if you go to the website that I listed for our Disabilities and Violence Project, we have a specific chapter on communicating on issues related to deaf or hard of hearing, as well as some resources to contact for some of what they call these assistive technologies that make it possible.
Thank you for that explanation, Amy, and thank you for the listener who emailed that in. And the website that Amy just referenced is on the very last slide of her PowerPoint. Finally, Amy, I just had one other clarifying kind of question.
Sure.
to ask you. You referenced a guardianship letter, and you said that that was the terminology relative to Wisconsin. But how would an advocate find a guardianship or access a guardianship letter?
What you can do is for each of the programs, what they can do is call their county court, probate court. Usually guardianships, and you might have to double check your state statutes or call your state level coalition. They might specifically know which courts in your state cover guardianships. If they're different from in Wisconsin, for example, it's the probate court. So what I would do in my county, if I wanted to get a copy of what the court issued for the guardianship, I would call the county probate court and ask for the clerk, or maybe go down there, say who I was or show my identification, and I would specifically get a signed informed consent form from the victim survivor to ensure that she knows that I'm getting the papers, not because I'm questioning her, but because I want to make sure that something unexpected doesn't happen as we're providing support and services to her.
And so those are public documents, so
correct.
An advocate would be able to access that.
Yep, with as long as they have a release, I think that would make it very smooth.
Okay.
What you might want to do, again, is check ahead, either with your state coalition or another resource I provided you on the last page of the handout on the web resources, through the National Association of Adult Protective Services. You can connect to each state-level Adult Protective Service office, and they should have, at each state level, resources and information about where you can go with regard to guardianship in particular counties or parishes. And so that would be another way to kind of work your way down to who you would need to call or contact and what would be required as far as documentation in each community. That's the hard part of these teleconferences because we all know, you know, my state is different from your state, but I would recommend that be the process you go through.
And probably anyone interested would be able to Google the National Association of Adult Protective Services, right?
Exactly. And the website is in the handout, the PowerPoint.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Terrific. Thank you for explaining
that.
Operator, are there any questions at this time?
There's no one lined up in the question queue, but again, if you do have a question, simply press the number 1 once.
Okay. Very good. Thank you, operator. So, Amy... Sorry about that. I have just a few, couple of minutes after the top of the hour, so we have just a little less than half an hour left, and I certainly want to allow time for your explanation of, as we kind of delve into more of the legalities with this, and then also stop one more time for questions towards the end.
So fabulous.
We'll go right back into it.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Okay. Mandatory reporting. As it says in the slide, and you all probably know best in your states, some states require that certain individuals report suspected or known abuse committed against individuals with disabilities. Every state is going to be different, so I want to be clear that I'm talking generally here. Okay. Some states, for example, there's one state that requires everyone to report. It doesn't matter whether you're a therapist or a neighbor. You're required to report. Other states, it's specific to maybe a particular degree that you have or license or a particular entity that you work for. So what you'll want to do is find out about your state law. And if you haven't had the opportunity to do that yet, what I would do, again, is check with your Adult Protective Services office to learn whether or not there's any mandatory reporting or any kind of reporting requirement with regard to abuse of people with disabilities. If you decide to try and look it up on the web, a lot of states, not all, but a lot of states define this as vulnerable adult reporting, okay? Now, in the binder that you were given for this presentation, there is an excellent, excellent piece. And while it's focused specifically on elder abuse, Often you'll see in state statutes that elders and vulnerable adults or people with disabilities are put together in a statute with regard to reporting. So the document that you would definitely want to take a look at that's in your binder for this call, it's called Mandatory Reporting of Elder Abuse, Implications for Domestic Violence Advocates. Again, that's only a starting place. You will want to check and find out for sure what your state statutes require and figure out then whether or not you fall under that statute, whether or not you and your particular role would be required to report and under what circumstances, and then whether or not the person with a disability actually is covered by the reporting law. It just depends how everything is defined. And I know lawyers talk about, you know, you can't say yes or no, it depends. But that's just the way the language is written. So we have to be really clear here about figuring out who the law applies to as far as people with disabilities, whether or not you specifically or anyone in your organization would be required to report, who they have to report to, when, how quickly do they have to report once you learn that abuse might be taking place or has taken place. So I would strongly recommend if your domestic violence program does not have any kind of policy or procedure in place at this time regarding reporting and people with disabilities, that you take a look at that. Maybe mention to the executive director to basically figure out what the process is going to be if there is mandatory reporting in your state. So, for example, even though I might be a licensed social worker working in a domestic violence program, maybe I'm working as an advocate even though I have that license, but I'm not providing direct clinical therapy of any kind. So even though I have the license, I might not be required to report. Or I'm that licensed social worker, but we have a policy in our domestic violence program that the executive director is going to be the one that makes all the mandatory reports when they have to be made. So what you'll want to do is, for direction, maybe take a look at the policies and procedures you have in place for child abuse reporting, and then see what applies and how you want to craft a specific agency policy with regard to any reporting requirements you have for people with disabilities or vulnerable adults. The other piece that you want to remember is that you also want to make sure that if you are required to report, that you make sure to let the person with the disability know that you're a mandated reporter and make sure they know before they disclose anything so they can make an informed choice about whether or not they want to work with you at that stage. If they do and they know you're a mandated reporter, maybe one, giving them the opportunity to make the report, or two, making the report with them. So that they can be aware that you're just not another part of the system, not listening and not doing what they want. I think the hard part is knowing when we are required to report, if we are, when the victim has been very clear that he or she does not want us to report. And I think if we can keep the door open with victims, even knowing that we have to report, that's part of talking through and figuring out, as programs, as advocates, how we can go about doing that in the most respectful way that we can. There are a lot of issues regarding reporting, confidentiality issues, depending on what our state and program requirements are. There are issues with reporting that come up with privilege, especially if you have an advocate victim privilege in your state. We don't have the time to go into the detail, but I would strongly recommend that if you have a mandatory reporting requirement, that you all as a program meet with an attorney, work with your state-level coalitions to try and figure out how best to navigate the conflicting issues that arise when it comes to mandatory reporting, confidentiality, and privilege. It's a tough area. It's a very tough area. Some of the other legal considerations that you have to take into account when working with people with disabilities come about because of some of the federal laws that exist. Basically, they're considered civil rights laws that apply to people with disabilities and others. Primarily, we're talking about the ADA or the Americans with Disabilities Act and the new Amendments Act that was passed in 2009. Issues related to access and anti-discrimination based on Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. The Fair Housing Act, for those of you who run shelter programs or transitional housing, there are effects from ADA 504 that apply to housing for people with disabilities under the Fair Housing Act. So these are some of the laws at the federal level that we have to be thinking about. And what I want to share with you are two things. One, the laws, as we know, can be complex, and they can raise questions about how we want to apply them. I'm not going to walk through each law, but what I want to let you know is a couple things. One, I've attached to the binder a number of documents that provide pretty solid legal analysis, in my opinion, from our collaborative work here in Wisconsin about these laws, their applications specific to domestic violence and sexual assault programs. I do want to highlight, however, that there have been some recent changes that won't go into effect until probably the end of 2011 or early 2012, some specific changes in definitions and application. We are going to be updating our materials to reflect those changes in federal law, and I will make sure that Liz has those updated resources so that if you all want to avail yourselves of them, you can do so. But I just wanted to let you know we've got some changes. Primarily, what we have to be thinking about for people with disabilities in our programs is how it affects intervention and the day-to-day services and support we provide. Accommodations are really the biggest issues that come up. And what it is it really is about access for people with disabilities. And when you talk about access, you have to think broadly. It's people's attitudes, our own attitudes and comfort, any policies or procedures that we have in place that might unintentionally discriminate or even intentionally. For example, I'm aware of a program that used to have not necessarily a written policy, but when women would call in and several questions were asked because the woman was trying to get into shelter due to domestic violence, basically the program said that they don't work with women with mental illness. Let me just be very clear, that is a violation of a number of different federal disability laws. Because that's a person with a disability, and under Title III, for example, of the ADA, domestic violence and sexual assault programs are considered public accommodations and can't discriminate against people with disabilities. So there can be policies or ways of doing business that really are a barrier to access. Or maybe I can come use your program, but I can't get through your door or up your steps because I use a wheelchair. Or I'm deaf and I use ASL and there's no availability of an interpreter and I can't communicate with an advocate. So we really have to think about access very broadly. I want to just highlight very quickly, because I know we're going out of time, running out of time. I hear weekly from programs who are struggling working with women with mental health issues, who feel like they're not sure they're providing the most effective services, as well as a lot of staff feel frustrated or confused or unsure about whether or not services from domestic violence programs are appropriate for women with mental health issues. Working as I do with a lot of victim survivors of violence who have mental health diagnoses, who have lived in psychiatric wards and institutions, I will tell you, your services to them are a lifeline. And so we have to figure out ways to work more effectively with each other. So part of what I think would be helpful for programs to do is to work with, contact your state protection and advocacy agency, and that web address, the National Disability Rights Network, is listed in your resources. Find out who some of the mental health consumer groups are around your state, and sit down and have some conversations about what works and what doesn't work from both perspectives, so we can be as accommodating and open to all women as possible. With regard to what you have to think about as far as accommodations, is each of your programs may ask all program participants whether they need any accommodations to participate in programs and services, okay? So what you can do is basically just say, is there anything that you need? Maybe materials in large print or anything that would be helpful so that you can participate in the support group, so that you can come into shelter. And ask that question not only when the person is initially calling or going through some kind of an intake process, but maybe if they're in shelter or in support group, after they've gotten somewhat comfortable, ask again. I might be more willing to tell you what I need when I've built up some trust and decided that this is a good place where I can get some help. Okay? I'm skipping through things here, and I apologize for that. I know we just have two more minutes. With regard to communication, and this has to do with access as well, what you want to do is make sure that the language that you're using is clear to the person that's receiving it. We know for deaf, for example, that often it's a fourth or fifth grade level of English that they understand. It has nothing to do with their intelligence. It's just usually English is their second language. For individuals who have other cognitive disabilities, the simplicity of the language, the clarity, the concreteness is what's going to make a difference, making sure the person is fully understanding what you're saying, slowing down the pace, making sure that the words you're using aren't the kinds of phrases that we use in the movement that have no meaning or understanding to them. We also want to make sure on our written materials that the language is clear, that it's simple, that we provide our brochures, our forms, any information we're giving out in other alternative formats. Large print, which is basically 18-point font. Don't make it the fancy, fancy font on your computer. Use Helvetica. Use something that's very straight and defined. It's easier for people with low vision. Don't use bright, contrasting colors. Black or white is sometimes the best. And the same is true for when we have websites or anything that we send out electronically. We have to be thinking about, is this going to be usable by everyone who's seeking our services? And then very finally, don't do it alone. There are lots of us out here who work in the disability field for disability advocacy organizations who have great admiration, and I say that very, very sincerely, for the work that you all do. But we don't know a lot about domestic violence or sexual assault, so come work with us. Come teach us. Let's work together, and vice versa. You all can benefit from connecting with and learning from disability organizations. There's just not enough money and time and people to go around for all of us to do everything. So let's leverage what we have, leverage the commitment to person-centered services and support, and work together. And I guess I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Amy. Sorry, I know you had to kind of talk at twice your normal rate.
That's okay.
But there was a lot of really important information to get through, so thank you for that. Operator, could you tell me if there are any questions in the question queue at this point?
There is no one in the question queue at this time. If we do want to take a final call again to ask a question or if you have a comment, simply press the number 1.
Very good. Thank you. While we wait to allow a few minutes for you to formulate your thoughts and your questions, I, of course, have a couple of things I wanted to ask you about, Amy, if I can.
Great.
First of all, do you have any recommendations? Are there any, I don't know, law firms or kind of legal rights groups in which there might be reduced service rates or pro bono services available to programs in accessing legal help in, you know, kind of around all these issues?
Oh, I imagine people on the other end are probably struggling with this too. You know, legal resources, I think we're all aware, are just there's just not enough. I will tell you that all of the disability, the protection and advocacy agencies around the country, and there is one in every state and U.S. territory, we all have legal services available for people with disabilities. And I will tell you that, and we're federally funded through Congress, one of our primary focuses via our mandate from Congress is abuse of people with disabilities. Now, I will not tell you that every PNA, that's what we call ourselves, Protection and Advocacy Agency, understands abuse in the context of domestic violence. That's where folks on this call can really help, because there can be legal services maybe that my organization can't provide, but we're connected with a lot of lawyers all over the state. You know, I'm a lawyer. There are many lawyers here. But, you know, especially in rural communities, it's finding those other legal services at reduced or no cost. And we could help facilitate, PNAs could help facilitate that in communities around the country. So I would recommend scheduling an opportunity to talk with someone at your PNA. And if you're looking for particular contact names or you're unsure how to approach your protection and advocacy agency, feel free to email me, and I'll be glad to help. You know, I could even make a call for you just to open the door if that would be helpful.
Terrific. That's fabulous information. I would imagine very, very helpful. Operator, are there any questions at the moment?
No, no one has entered the question queue so far.
All right. We have a quiet group with us today. But
that's okay.
Yep, that is just fine. No problem. Again, if there are any final thoughts, you're welcome to email me, and you can do so by sending your note to Liz, L-I-Z, at praxisinternational.org. I did have one other question that I meant to clarify with you earlier.
Sure.
And we'll have to backtrack a little bit in terms of content. But when you when we were talking about substitute decision makers,
yeah,
you had outlined the three different types. But I wondered if you could just give some, you know, just a really brief overview about what the difference those types make in terms of the advocacy that people are doing with the women, perhaps, in their shelter?
Sure. The three different types, and they may come under different names in your particular states, but it's basically guardians. Then there are documents called powers of attorney, and there are usually two, a power of attorney for health care and a power of attorney for finances. Some states also call them advanced directives. and then three are conservatorships. So I explain guardians because that's the most common for people with disabilities. But, for example, if I'm someone who has a spinal cord injury, I have no capacity issues as far as my thinking process is concerned, I might have a power of attorney. And what that basically means is I've asked someone that I trust, basically, that if I become, let's say I have to go in for surgery to get something else repaired as a result of my car accident, that if I'm unable to make, for example, health care decisions at that time, that that person that I designated in my power attorney then has the power to make those health care decisions that I defined in the power of attorney document. Okay, so that might come into play, for example, for a domestic violence or sexual assault program if someone has a power of attorney or advance directive regarding, let's say, their finances. And maybe you're working with an individual who has been in shelter, who is healing well, who wants to set up her own apartment and get her own employment history and is really motivated, but all of a sudden you learn that control of any finances or assets that she has is not with her, but with this other decision maker. And so you would basically then need to, again, see that power of attorney document, figure out what kind of informed consent you'd need from that other person in order to move forward with the victim survivor's wishes. And then the third is probably going to be the least common. You may never see it in your actual practice as advocates, and that's conservatorship. That's becoming less and less common among people with disabilities, but it basically mostly applies to property and assets.
Thank you. Those are important distinctions. Thank you for taking the time. I know I was asking you to just give a quick little overview of it, and I apologize for shortchanging, just the extent of the definitions that need to be made. But thank you for that, Amy.
Sure.
Operator, are there any other questions? Any questions on the line?
We sure don't have anyone in the queue at this time. Again, if you have a question or any comments at all you need to do is press the number one.
All right, very good. Well, and it is entirely possible that you may not have any questions or comments until after this call has been completed. And if that's the case, Amy welcomes your feedback and comments and questions. And so please feel free to email her at the email address that is identified in the binder. And also I just will refer you to the second to the last slide, and the very last slide in her PowerPoint provides a list of really excellent resources. So should you want to follow up on them, they are available to you, as well as the resources in the binder, I think, will provide a lot of really helpful insight. So, Amy, I cannot thank you enough for the time that you have taken for our call today. You've been really clear and consistent and very easy to follow along with, and so thank you so much for your presentation today.
Thanks, everyone.
And to all of you, thank you for joining us on our call today.
Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.